Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. The vault hangs open. Will you walk inside with us?
Yes, do walk inside, because we're going to be cracking out our old episodes on techno-religion, part one and part two. This is going to be part one.
Yeah, so when did these originally publish?
So part one here originally published on June 9th, 2015.
Oh, this was one of my first episodes.
Yeah.
Way back when I was a brand new baby on this show. I wanted to talk about some intersections between technology and religion. So we did. And Robert, it was a lot of fun. I still remember those days very fondly.
Yeah, we got two long episodes out of it. And the cool thing is I think we have the potential to do a third techno-religion episode in the future. So keep that in mind as you're listening to all of this. And certainly shoot us an email if you can think of a wonderful example of religious technology that we should include.
I think we heard after this episode from at least one academic who was doing a dissertation on techno-religion.
Oh, well, I'd forgotten about that. We'll have to reach out to them.
Anyway, here is our classic episode on techno-religion for the masses, part one. And of course, next weekend, if you want to tune back in on Saturday, we will be re-airing part two. So here's part one. Enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
We may say that we have the birth of a new science, a new philosophy, a new life. The time of deliverance has come at last, and henceforward the career of humanity is upward and onward, a mighty, a noble, and a godlike career. All the revelations of spiritualism heretofore, all the control of spirits over mortals, and the instruction and discipline they have given us have only paved the way, as it were, for the advent of a great practical movement, such as the world little dreams of, though it has long deeply yearned for it and agonized and groaned away its life because it did not come sooner. And this new motive power is to lead the way in the great speedily coming salvation. It is to be the physical savior of the race, the history of its inception, its various stages of progress, and its completion will show the world a most beautiful and significant analogy to the advent of Jesus as the spiritual savior of the race. Hence, we most confidently assert that the advent of the science of all sciences the philosophy of all philosophies, and the art of all arts has now fairly commenced. The child is born, not long hence he will go alone. Then he will dispute with the doctors in the temples of science, and then...
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Joe, what is going on here?
I'm reading a quote. This is a quote from a Boston newspaper, the June 28th, 1854 edition of a Boston newspaper called The New Era, or Heaven Opened to Man. And this passage was written by a former Universalist minister named Simon Hewitt. So after this passage, one skeptical reader named Emma Hardinge commented that, quote, "Nothing could be given further beyond vague hints of what was to follow the awful then, which broke off breathless at the contemplation of its own inexpressible possibilities." So all this preamble to something amazing that's going to change humanity, what on earth could Simon Hewitt have been talking about? Well, he was referring to something that sat inside the upper room of a large tower overlooking the coast beyond the town of Lynn, Massachusetts. This is High Rock Tower. If you want to look it up, you can see a picture of this place. It still exists to kind of get a sense of it. And inside the upper room of this tower were the fruits of what I would sort of think of as the ultimate backyard engineering project. It is like garage engineering gone to the extreme. So from July 1853 to the following spring in 1854, a group of Universalist reformers and spiritualist enthusiasts had been building a machine called the New Motor. And it would be something I'd say probably never seen before on Earth, an electromechanical messiah.
Yes, which, you know, this will bring to mind a number of different stunning visuals, which we would like to... dissuade you from. We'll make sure we have some links to some images of the electrical messiah in question on the landing page for this episode. But if you think about a Dalek
from Doctor Who,
if a Dalek were to breed with a coffee table, their offspring
right.
would
and
probably resemble this.
Be decorated with many like dangling Christmas ornaments.
Yes. So it's a hybrid of a coffee table and a Dalek decorated for Christmas. And serving as kind of an altarpiece as well. There's certainly an altarpiece vibe to this creation.
Sure. And this is bridging two worlds that we tend to see as sort of, I don't know what spectrum it is, but they're, whatever it is, they're at the opposite ends of the spectrum. One is religion and the other is technology. I mean, we typically think of religion as a very low-tech affair. You tend to go into churches, I don't know, maybe not some churches these days, but you see a lot of stuff that recalls an earlier time. And our religious texts in most of the major religions of the world are very ancient, and thus the metaphors in which we talk about our religions tend to be very ancient. And technology is, you know, it's the very essence of what is new and what the future is. I mean, what is science fiction that imagines the future usually focused on? It's new technology.
Yeah, I mean, most of the major world religions, yeah, they're based on ancient cosmologies that sometimes we're okay with updating. Generally, at certain points in the past, we will say, all right, we're going to actually change this a little bit to fit how we live now. But for the most part, yeah, they're rooted in the past, and technology is ever rooted in the present and in the future.
Right. But today we want to discuss what happens when you cram the ends of that spectrum together and you create techno-religion. So what happens when technology changes religions? What happens when technology becomes a component of religious practice? And what happens when technology becomes a god or messiah in itself?
Right. And this is something that has been happening for ages. If you think of technology in the broader sense especially, humans have always been developing new technologies, developing gadgets, developing more advanced ways of just looking at the world around them and manipulating the world around them. And this has always gone hand in hand with our ability to understand the purpose of life and the purpose of our existence here on Earth.
Yeah, and the concept of purpose is also built into the idea of technology. Because we typically think of technology as like a machine or a mechanism that does a particular job. But if you look at the standard dictionary definition of technology, it's going to say something like the practical application of scientific knowledge toward a purpose.
So keep all of that in mind. Keep those definitions in mind as we explore the convergence of technology and religion.
Yeah. So I was wondering, what are some of the earliest examples of the religious use of a machine? Like, you can only think back so far. I mean, of course, nowadays people might, I don't know, read devotional literature on their iPad or something. But is there anything people have been doing for hundreds or thousands of years with machines to help them in their spiritual journeys?
Yes. In fact, we have a couple of really good examples of this, the first of which is the prayer wheel, which I imagine most people have seen images or footage of these, particularly if you've ever traveled into East Asia or had any kind of contact with Buddhism. But these tend to be we're talking about a wheel and spindle composed of various materials. You'll find them made out of ornate metals. You'll find them made out of stone. You'll find them made out of leather and cotton. And it's a physical manifestation of the turning wheel of Dharma in Buddhism.
Okay, so physically, to picture this, is it going to be kind of like one of those game prize wheels?
Sort of. I mean, it's not positioned vertically. It's positioned horizontally. It kind of, if you were just an outsider looking at it and you knew nothing about Eastern religion, you might equate it with some sort of a doodad at a child's playground, right? Just something that seems like you just spin it and it's cool to spin.
Okay.
But of course, it has far more purpose than that within the context of the religion.
So the wheel of Dharma.
Yeah, the wheel of Dharma. And it's all tied in with, accumulating good karma, purifying bad karma, because you spin this wheel, and in spinning the prayer wheel, you are, assisting, yourself with the purging of bad karma and the accumulation of the good.
Huh.
And this is accomplished, by the fact that, I mean, on top of the wheel being this gadget, this device that represents this cosmological idea, the prayers are also filled with up to a mile of prayers. So we're talking mantras and sutras, generally written in Sanskrit, and the prayers are recited each time the wheel makes a revolution. So a pilgrim spins the wheel, and with each spin helps them gain merit and to concentrate the mind on the mantras and sutras that are being reenacted by the wheel.
Oh, okay. So much in the way that, say, a lever or a pulley might upgrade our ability to do physical work, this wheel can upgrade our ability to do spiritual work.
Yeah. One way to think of it would be think about a cassette player, right?
Yes.
Say you're just a really huge fan of I don't know what's your favorite metal album, your favorite rock and roll album.
Dope Throne.
Who's that by?
Electric Wizard.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's say you particularly love Dope Throne, and so you have a cassette of Dope Throne, but that cassette doesn't actually play. But imagine this: the mere act of that tape filtering through the machine and revolving around that wheel somehow enacted the spirit of that album for you.
Okay.
See? That's kind of what's going on
here. So it gives you the essence or the aura of Dope Throne without the sounds having to play.
Right. And ideally, I think my understanding too is that you would also focus the mind on Dope Throne. So it's not just saying I'm turning this machine, instead of thinking about it, I'm doing both.
Okay.
But where this gets really interesting is when you look at the fact that until the 20th century, virtually the only Tibetan use for the wheel was as a device for activating these mantras. So that the wheel virtually went unused there as a physical tool, as a technology for moving things around or crushing things, etc. It was used almost exclusively as a religious technology.
Wow.
Yeah. Now that's not to say that all prayer wheels are turned by hand. That's kind of the main one you see, and it's certainly the one that often makes the biggest impression visually. That's a Mani wheel. But there are also varieties that are turned by fire, water, wind, electricity.
Hold on a second. So we've got an electric prayer karma machine.
Yes. Yeah. This is where it gets really interesting because it's one thing to say, all right, this one is spun by hand. Because also I'm the human. I'm kind of at the center of this religious thing, right? It's another to say the fire or the wind or the air is going to move it, because those are natural forces created by the gods, right?
Yeah, well, that makes me think of an analogy. Like if you look to medieval Catholicism, where you might have chantries that are where, say, a wealthy person or member of the gentry could pay people to pray. Mm. And the more prayers that the monks would say in these chantries based on the amount they paid could lessen their stay in purgatory. I wonder if, you know, if they'd had this kind of technology at the time, would they think, well, would it be okay to say the number of prayer machines you build could lessen your stay in purgatory? Could you get one of those text-to-speech synthesizers to say prayers?
You know, I don't know. I would definitely love to hear from someone with more insight into the rules of Tibetan Buddhism and these prayer wheels, because it would seem like you could just buy a bunch of these things and just set them up, plug them in, and let them go, and then maybe just completely externalize your karma situation. They call these Thardo Corlos. And you can keep them running 24 hours a day using a 4.5-volt DC electric current. So you can just keep it running all the time, presumably when you're sleeping, when you're eating, when you're doing things that I assume do not involve the mental concentration.
It's like a karmic force field generator.
Exactly, yeah. And this is even crazier when you think of another technological innovation that you see with the prayer wheels, and that's that you can also find microfilm prayer wheels that contain even more than a million mantras inside them. So,
oh wow,
yeah. So you, between microfilm technology and just simple electric technology to create a spinning wheel, you can really sort of change your karma game, it seems.
The microfilm is especially interesting to me. It seems like that's almost like a religious implementation of the idea of nanotechnology, like
yeah.
Accomplishing more in a smaller space.
It makes me wonder, and perhaps someone has done something along these lines, but why even deal with the physical wheel? What if you took the wheel virtually? You could have – I mean, what would the limits – there would be, pretty much be no limits, right? I mean, you could
right.
have an absurd number of mantras moving through a wheel at pretty much any kind of rate you want. Right?
Like you could create a computer program that executes a subroutine that is just a list of these mantras, and
yeah.
then you could tell it to loop infinitely.
Yeah, kind of a karmic defragging system just running in the background of your computer at all times.
Yeah, and of course, so this is kind of our outsider's perspective, but I'm sure somebody who is actually believing in and using these sorts of prayer wheels would have a pretty good and well thought out explanation for why you can use technology to achieve a karmically significant event in one way but not in another way. It might totally make sense in terms of how they interpret their spirituality.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you see this convergence of technology and religion, it becomes the domain of the priest or the priest class or somebody in some sort of clerical authority to say, all right, this is the line. This is how far technology can come into the sanctuary.
Right.
It's okay to read your hymnal or your Bible on an iPad, but it's not okay to do X, Y, or Z.
It makes me want to ask the question, why on that spectrum I talked about earlier where we have, the ancient religion on one hand and the new technology on the other, why are they so far apart? Like what is the inherent profanity in technology?
Hmm.
It does kind of seem crass when you see a religious service taking place on a Jumbotron or something
yeah.
like that. Why is that? Like what is wrong with the technology or what is necessarily unspiritual about it? I don't know the answer, but there seems to be an intuition like that we have.
Well, I guess so much of it is rooted in tradition, you know? I mean, I've definitely had that moment before where I've been at a church service and the person giving the sermon or, her officiating at a wedding has been reading off of a Kindle or a pad of some kind.
Yeah, it looks inappropriate.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that religions tend to be inherently traditional, especially the older, traditional religions. So just the image of modern technology, especially when you think of technology as this thing that's such a mastery of human skill and ability, to see that you know, shoehorned in with these things that are supposedly given to us from some sort of a higher power.
Yeah. Though I wonder if people in the ancient world would have thought about it in the same way. I mean, this again calls to mind something we talked about the last time I was on the show when we talked about eclipses, which is the Antikythera mechanism.
Oh, yeah.
It was an ancient Greek device. It's often referred to as the world's oldest computer or the first computer. Now, obviously, it didn't have microprocessors or anything, but this was a device that comes from more than 2,000 years ago. It was found in a shipwreck in the Mediterranean, and it was an ancient mechanical computer for computing the locations of celestial objects and for like predicting lunar eclipses and solar eclipses in the future. And the interesting thing about this is it's an amazingly advanced piece of technology for the time, just astoundingly advanced. But these events, these celestial mechanics, had religious significance to the people who used it.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something we discussed in that eclipse episode. When you look back at ancient societies, and even not so ancient societies, astronomy and cosmology are so linked together. Like, it becomes the domain of the priests and the clergy to know what the stars are doing, to track the stars, so that we know what the calendar is telling us and when certain rites should be observed.
Well, that makes me wonder if star tracking technology has entered religion, even ancient religion, in the same way the prayer wheel did.
Yes, and that brings us to the astrolabe.
The astrolabe.
Yeah, now everyone I think has probably seen an image of an astrolabe in their finer forms. These are just works of just pure art.
I'm going to tell you what I picture. Tell me how far off I am.
Okay.
Basically, it looks kind of like that compass you used to use in middle school math classes to draw a perfect circle with another little half moon piece on it. Is that completely wrong?
Kind of, yeah. With varying levels of artistry and a lot of figures and sliding mechanisms.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a small circular device, and these would usually be made of wood or brass, and they date back over 2,000 years. The concept seems to originate around 330 BCE, and they were perfected by the Arabs in the 9th century, and they remained the basic astronomer's tool for the next 700 years. It's essentially a model of the stars in the sky, which can be moved to show where the stars will be at any time of the year. And the reverse side of the astrolabe concerns the position of the sun and the moon.
Okay, so it's a lot like the Antikythera mechanism in a way.
Yeah, yeah. It's portable. It has a large display. On top of that, if you have a really nice model, it's a beautiful work of art, something you might want to, you know, easily show it off at the dinner table. It's arguably one of, if not the first, personal computer, you know, mobile, carrying it with you,
right,
doing what you need to do in the course of a day.
Now, the question is, would it become overheated if sitting on your lap?
If it was made out of metal and you were seated in the sun, I would say yes.
Yeah, that's a sterility hazard.
You couldn't get an app for this thing, but it had a number of features just by virtue of how it contracted the heavens. You could tell the date and time. You could calculate distances. It could be used in determining a building height, surveying, longitude, latitude, altitude, horoscopes. You can also figure out the position of the planets. But then on top of this, there were various occult usages. So it gets a little bit into religion there. But the most notable function, where we see the astrolabe becoming a piece of religious technology, is in its ability to determine Islamic prayer times and determine the direction to Mecca.
Ah, okay. So this is actually that the piece of technology itself doesn't necessarily have religious significance, but there's a fact you need to know to execute your religion, you know, perfectly, the way you want to do it. If you want to face Mecca as well as you can, why not have a machine to help you really hone that piece of information and get it as accurate as possible?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it really becomes an essential piece of technology in Islam, because Islam places a high importance on the position of the believer in time and space. For starters, the Salat times, these are the five prayers a day plus the Friday prayer, it depends on a combination of clock time and sundial time to determine exactly when these should take place. So it concerns the exact coordinates for a given location. because again, it's not just arbitrary about when the prayer times are. They are
right.
Specific depending on where you are in the world, where you are in terms of sun time. And on top of this, the faithful has to know exactly where they are in relation to the Kaaba in Mecca so that they can face that direction during these prayers.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And unlike the prayer wheel, which itself does some sort of religious or spiritual work, mm-hmm. this is sort of like a technology that we use to be most properly informed about how to do the rituals that you would be doing anyway.
Because really, a lot of the problems that occur in a religion, they occur as the believer moves farther away in time or space, right?
Sure.
So you're farther away from Mecca. It's harder to determine exactly where you are. You're not necessarily going to have somebody signaling the prayer times each day from a tower. So
right.
It falls on you to figure it out yourself. And then that's where the technology becomes extremely useful. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But of course, there are lots of external influences on how we practice our religions. a lot of these influences are actually going to be technological. One of the things that I thought was interesting was to think about writing itself as a technology. Now, writing is so crucial to the way we think of most of the major religions of the world today, because you've got the Torah for Jews, you've got the, you know, the Hebrew Bible plus the New Testament for Christians, you've got the Quran for Muslims, and of course there are texts that are central to Eastern religions as well.
Mm-hmm. The Ramayana and the Mahabharata, to be specific.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah. And so we think about religion as a very text-based affair, but there's really no reason it has to be. I mean, religions can be transmitted orally through culture. They can be systems of cultural practices that don't necessarily have to be written down or encoded anywhere. But for some reason, most of the world's major religions have a strong textual component. And I wonder how it changed the way we practiced religion when writing came into humanity. Because writing – I mean, human civilization is much older than writing. Mm-hmm. Of course, human life in general, human culture is even older than civilization, so much older than writing. So we can only really imagine, I think, I'm sure that some, like a cultural anthropologist or an archaeologist could tell us more about how they think writing might have changed the way we practice religions, but I really have no idea.
Well, I mean, I think at heart you're probably dealing with the situation of the expansion of memory, right? Because writing is in essence the ability to externalize human memory. Before writing, we could only contain as much as could fit in a human mind. Mm-hmm. Or if you were, you know, really skilled at it, you might compartmentalize it, right? And have one person deal with these memories versus the other. Almost a Fahrenheit 451 kind of situation.
Oh, right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So before writing, you're limited by just the power of the human mind to remember and then the ability to pass that on to others.
Which, of course, we know from everyday experience but also from actual studies, we don't pass on information all that faithfully if we don't write it down.
Right. Memory itself is not set in stone.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of a telephone game anytime we pass something on. Anytime you remember something, you're taking it out, you're potentially changing it, and then putting it back in.
So, yeah, I have to imagine, though, of course, I could be wrong, that as much as religious beliefs kind of change from generation to generation today, I have to imagine they changed even more and much more quickly in times before there were sort of like texts to anchor them.
Yeah, before you could actually set a religion in stone, I imagine a religion really just by virtue of how we remembered it, it changed with us.
So it's very fluid.
Yeah. So some of these problems we run into where we're saying, oh, all right, we're trying to apply ancient Babylonian cosmology to modern times. Part of that is by virtue of depending upon ancient Babylonian cosmology set in stone, and then, you know, and then that recording of it is considered sacred and holy.
Right. So these ancient writing technologies, we of course had the invention of alphabets, and I think it's very fair to consider an alphabet a technology.
Mm-hmm.
But then on top of that, you just had the preservation technology. So you had scrolls, you eventually had codices, you had, you know, tablets and carving and all the different pictograms and libraries and every bit of technology we had. But there was one big thing, I think, that was the main textual technology that really revolutionized the world, and that would be the printing press.
Yes. Yeah, we're talking about the mid-15th century in Europe particularly.
Old Gutenberg.
Old Gutenberg, yeah. And his effect on the Bible, the Gutenberg Bible. Because prior to this, any given Western manuscript had to be copied by hand. And it was generally – this was something that was handled by the clergy.
Right. Can you imagine this, living in a world where – so you look to the church as your, you know, as your authority on all things spiritual, and probably more than that, also all things government in some cases and all that. But they have the Bible as the authority that's interpreted by the church. And so what is the Bible? Well, it is hand-copied documents that most people don't have much access to. They might be – because they're so rare. I mean, they're kept in scriptoriums or libraries or these places that the average person wouldn't have any access to.
Yeah, they're highly fetishized. It's just not something that the average person would have access to.
And on top of that, the lack of a printing press means that there's really not much distributed commentary on the documents either. Mm-hmm. And this is something that a lot of people would say played a big role in the Renaissance, Protestant Reformation, the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution. If you just look at the Protestant Reformation, you have to imagine the effect that the printing press had on not just the Bible itself, but on the distribution of Reformation propaganda. And I don't use the word propaganda there in a negative sense. I think that's just the term for all of the ways in which Reformation ideas were being spread throughout Europe at the time.
Yeah, it's really the kind of technological advancement in mass communication that you can really only compare it to, if not the emergence of writing to begin with, then perhaps the internet age.
Right.
Like such a big movement and such a drastic change in our ability to communicate with one another. Speaking of the scientific revolution, that makes me think about the, you know, the whole notion of a clockwork universe, which I'm not going to get too deep into that here. That could easily be its own podcast. But and everyone's heard the idea of a creator God as a watchmaker, right? This creator makes the perfect mechanical timepiece that is the universe and then just lets it go. Maybe winds it first, I guess. Hopefully winds it. And then lets it go because it doesn't need to be rewound or anything. It works perfectly as it's created. And this is an example of, you know, a technological society, a society that has these technological ideas in its head, can't help but think about the unseen world in terms of those same mechanisms.
Right. I mean, it's very common to want to describe the actions of God in terms that we can understand.
Right. And so, what do we understand these days?
Making machines.
Machines, yeah. I haven't seen a lot of this, but I wonder to what extent like modern like email or jargon, et cetera, has made its way into, you know, just average, say, Christian sermons. Like does anyone talk about communication with God, prayer itself being a form of email?
I do think a lot of the jokes now displayed on church signs come from email forwards.
Okay. Yeah, indeed. I believe I saw one church marquee here around town a few years back where they talked about sending God some, quote, knee mail.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that one.
Which I thought when I read knee mail, I was instantly thinking that sounds like a great name for some sort of a wrestling move, finishing maneuver, right, where you knee somebody in the head and you call it knee mail.
Right.
But they're, of course, talking about kneeling. And then praying, which is a form of knee mail.
Oh, that's adorable. I love that. Knee mail. But getting back to the ways that external advances in technology have affected the progression of religions, one of the ways that I think is very significant is looking at the way technology has changed the way we do work, mm-hmm. which, of course, is the main thing technology does, and how that affects religious beliefs about how we should do work.
Oh, you're talking, of course, about Shabbat.
Right, of course. So if you look at the way some Jews interpret teachings in the Torah on what should be done or not done on the Sabbath, there have been lots of ways in which new technologies have sort of intruded on the traditional understanding of what is accepted and forbidden to do on the day of rest.
Right. This is sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, in which Orthodox Jews are forbidden to work. Right, which is interesting, technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to drive a vehicle, of course.
Right. And so, of course, what you can guess from drive a vehicle is that a lot of these things aren't directly commandments stated in the Torah itself as an ancient document,
mm-hmm.
but they're interpretations that have come from the rabbis throughout the years about how we should apply the laws of the Torah to the new technological world we find ourselves in.
Right, because just by the basic laws and like the 39 different activities that are off limits, it would mean that you can't cook or light a fire. And by extension of that, the interpretation is that there would be no moving electricity through a circuit.
Okay, so by this interpretation, really if you want to be observant on the Sabbath, you should not press a button that causes an electrical device to turn on.
Right, and that's where it gets kind of tricky because there's some obvious examples that, you know, you could say, well, don't turn on the vacuum cleaner. Okay, well, I'm not going to turn on the vacuum cleaner because I'm also not going to vacuum.
Right.
But then you got to eat on the Sabbath, right? So,
yeah.
So what do you do about opening the refrigerator door?
Oh, because when you open the refrigerator door, a light comes on.
Exactly.
And that's your action of opening the door that has caused that light to ignite.
Yeah. So, I mean, for the longest, there was an easy workaround, right? You could either unscrew the bulb or you tape up that little button, right?
Right. So those are some pretty simple workarounds mm-hmm. for that some Orthodox Jews might use. But it gets more complicated than that in some scenarios.
Right. For instance, another classic workaround involved the use of an oven, right? Because you need to heat up food. You can't light your stove. You can't activate the oven by pushing the button. But if you activate the oven, you turn it on before sundown on Friday and just leave it running through and keep it warm, you know, through sundown on Saturday, then you can make use of that heat. You're just setting it in motion beforehand and then picking up after the Sabbath is done.
I'd imagine a lot of ovens today are programmed not to do that because
exactly.
they don't want – it would be a safety hazard to just leave an oven on and leave town or something.
Yeah.
So they probably have like an automatic shutoff, right?
They do, yeah, an automatic safety shutoff. And when they started using these, you know, they were getting complaints from people who needed to keep their oven on in order to observe the religious practices. So This is where we get Sabbath mode on various appliances.
Not where they play Sabbath albums.
Right. Though that was certainly an innovation that would be great on modern.
Welcome in my house.
A Black Sabbath mode on your dishwasher, etc. But no, this would involve simply a manual override to the safety features so that you could operate your cooking technology in accordance with your religious faith.
You know, I bet that there are specific manufacturers that do this.
There are. And in fact, there's actually something called Star K Kosher Certification for Appliances.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can actually go to their website. It's star-k.org. And they have a lot of stuff dealing with kosher, you know, foods, what have you, but also in a whole section on appliances where you can look up the appliances and see what their potential Sabbath modes are, how to activate them, how to use them in accordance with these rules and regulations.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor.
It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Another classic example about the Shabbat and technology is the use of an elevator, right?
Increasingly,
you need to use an elevator to move around in a high-rise building. How do you do it if you can't push a button? Well, you just simply program the elevator during the Shabbat to go from floor to floor to floor to floor, up and down, nonstop. And then you just get on and you just ride the ride.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that might be a long ride and a long wait, but at least you can observe your practices.
Exactly. Another bit of religious technology we wanted to touch on real quick is a 16th century clockwork monk created by Juanelo Torriana, who was a mechanic for Spanish Emperor Charles V. Mm. Now, the emperor's son, King Philip II, the story goes, was praying at the bedside of his own dying son. And he's getting desperate, so he's making promises to the divine. He's promising a miracle for a miracle if his child survives. He ends up recovering, and he has to keep his promise. What kind of a miracle can a king actually do? Well, obviously, the king's going to
consult his
mechanic and get him to create a miracle as kind of an offering, right? As a thank you to the divine. And so that's where Juanelo comes in, and he creates a key wound spring operated automaton. And a really complicated automaton at that.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of this, and it's fascinating. You can, like, I think there's a little compartment where you can peek in on the inside of it, and it's got gears, and I couldn't begin to understand how it works on the inside. But what does it actually do?
Well, I mean, it walks around in kind of a square shape. It strikes its chest with its right arm. It raises and lowers a small cross and rosary with its left. It occasionally kisses the cross. It turns and nods its head, it rolls its eyes, and it mouths, silent prayers and whatnot.
Wow. You said it strikes its chest, so is this automatic self-flagellation?
I don't think it's quite flagellation.
Okay.
but that would be a different, that would be an interesting
A different kind of gesture.
Altogether. Yeah. Some of you probably heard a Radiolab episode a few years back where they did a short profile of this piece and sort of the mysteries around it, because there are a lot of questions regarding, why was this created? What's the exact purpose? What was the mindset in creating it? Mm-hmm. Is it simply an offering, to God? Is it something you're supposed to put on the table and you all sit around and pray while observing it?
Right. My question would be, does it do something relevant, or is it more kind of like when a great painter or sculptor would create a work of art and dedicate it to the Lord?
I think that seems to be the prevalent interpretation. Mm-hmm. Though in light of what we talked about with the prayer wheel, it's tempting to want to go that direction with it, and think of it as
to think that like its prayers had some efficacy.
Yeah, I mean, I really want to believe that. I can't in good faith put that forward as something that I think, or that even the majority of the experts think, that was in the mind of the king or the mechanic responsible, but. Mm-hmm. You can't help but wonder exactly how the mindset of the mechanic played into it. And, of course, in our modern time, we've plenty of examples of prayer taking place online, prayer groups, et cetera, sharing their concerns via the Internet. And I don't know to what extent they can, they ever consider the email itself a prayer.
Mm.
But certainly that seems like a line that will blur more and more as that becomes like standard practice, right? Because certainly, at some point, the written word became holy, right?
Sure.
And then I can't help but imagine that in the advent of the printing press, maybe initially the printed word was a little less holy, a little more manufactured.
Sure.
But then that becomes, de facto holy as well.
Right. Well, this is the other side of the advance of the textual technology progression, because religion is so inherently social in most the ways most people practice it. And it's something that deeply does involve communication between groups. And so allowing greater communication between people who think alike or want to offer each other religious advice or interpretation or consolation, the internet's obviously going to be a huge explosion in that. But it's also not just a peer-to-peer exchange, right? So you can have your sort of like your religious, you know, email circle where you forward each other the things that, you know, you want to show to your friends and your peers in the church. You can also have services provided by church officials over telecommunications links.
Indeed. And, you know, here's a question that comes to mind here. If it's blasphemous to burn or deface a religious text such as the Bible or the Quran, mm-hmm. what if you deleted an e-book of it?
Is that, oh, man.
Is that blasphemous? I don't know.
I don't know. I'm sure some people have opinions on that.
Yeah.
I personally do not.
Hey, and we haven't even mentioned exorcism online.
Right. Well, that would be one of those services that could be offered by, you know, your religious official who might be so far away. What if they're in a cabin in Alaska that hopefully has a fast internet connection, but they want to offer the spiritual service that you really need? And that might be the exorcism of a demon or multiple demons from your person.
Right. And there are individuals who have and continue to offer online exorcism services. Back in 2009, famed Israeli Kabbalah master Rabbi Batsri attempted to remove a dybbuk, a disembodied spirit, from a Brazilian man via the internet. And more recently, we've seen evangelical Reverend Bob Larson offering exorcisms for a fee, of course, via Skype. And this was actually featured on The Daily Show several months back.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, so I imagine
I didn't see that.
Imagine a number of our listeners caught it there.
Yeah, that sounds way more interesting than the video conferencing that we have here at work.
Yeah, but you know, ultimately, I don't see what the big deal is. Because if an exorcism involves like this rite by which you're driving a spiritual invader out,
yeah,
it's essentially the demon is kind of telecommuting through an individual, right?
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it seems to me that the ideology behind an exorcism would suggest that it's an interpersonal connection that breaks the power of the demon. It's sort of the spiritual or emotional or intellectual presence of the clerical official that can drive the demon out, not so much the physical presence. Like, why would they really need to be in the room?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of, I think we both recently rewatched portions or the entirety of the Hellraiser Bloodlines movie, where of course, you know, religious technology, right? The lament configuration is a little mechanical device, and you solve it, and the demons show up, the Cenobites show up. And in that movie, there's an individual that's cheating, right, by solving it virtually or remotely by use of a robot.
Right. Yes, he's using essentially the technology of a bomb disposal robot, mm-hmm. but to solve the lament configuration puzzle box inside a contained room. Initially it works, but then some people who are not very technologically savvy are like, well, we got to solve this problem. They open the door to the room where the Cenobites are contained, and then there's a big problem.
But that's interesting. Initially, they're able to outmaneuver the technologically empowered demons that are the Cenobites via more advanced technology.
Right. They can put those Cenobites in a box, inside a box.
Exactly.
Inside a box.
All right. So that's going to be the end of part one here. This is very much, again, a two-part series.
Yeah. And if you want to hear the conclusion of that story that we started this episode with, the construction of the electromechanical messiah at the High Rock Tower in Lynn, Massachusetts, that's going to be in our next episode. So that's going to be in part two.
Indeed. We're also going to get into some wonderful UFO and Scientology territory as well. So, hey, if you're listening to this episode as it comes out, just wait a couple of days and you'll get the second part. If you're catching up on this at a later point, I will make sure that there is a link to the second episode on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes, all the videos, all the blog posts, plus links out to our social media accounts such as Facebook and Twitter.
And if you want to let us know about any interesting thoughts you have or stories you've ever experienced about the intersection of religion and technology, or even the complete synthesis and marriage of religion and technology, email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.